Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. And this hour of the program, we are going to talk once again, as we have for many years now, about health care. As our guest writes in the Washington Post, last Friday, the Senate failed to pass a skinny repeal health care bill. And now the question is, what happens to Obamacare? Will it be fixed? Paige writes this in the Washington Post, and she says that moderate Democrats are stepping up with potential solutions for the beleaguered marketplace, which insures around 11 million Americans. But the jury is still out on whether Republican lawmakers can bring themselves to work across the aisle after such a humiliating defeat. So we have a lot to talk about the way forward for health care in this country. What happens to Obamacare? Will there be another vote in the Senate at some point, as the president would like? Will there be bipartisan fixing of the Affordable Care Act? We have two guests with us this hour. Paige Winfield Cunningham is a healthcare reporter, has joined us many times before. She's at the Washington Post and is the author of the Post Daily Health 202 newsletter. She's also reported at the Washington Examiner and at Politico. Later in the hour, Senator Tammy Baldwin will be joining us. She has this week introduced legislation to allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices to lower costs for seniors, and she has co-sponsored legislation to stabilize the health insurance marketplace and provide some certainty, so we will talk with her about that. All hour, this is a hot topic for all of you. Understandably, you can join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is ideas@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Paige, hello. Thanks for being with us again. Hello, Paige. Oh, she's not there, so we will try and connect with her in just a moment. The second hour of the program, as I come down to my last series of programs, we did an interview with Andrew Solomon some years ago, not that long ago, a few years ago, when he wrote Far From the Tree. And now Far From the Tree is a special book for young adults. It's the young adult edition of the book, How Children and Their Parents Learn to Accept One Another. Our differences unite us. He's an exceptional writer, and this was a 10-year project in which he visited with children and families where there are people who are deaf, children who are deaf, dwarfs, schizophrenia, criminals, those who were conceived in rape, and they're very, very moving stories, and he asks some pretty profound questions. So we will talk with Andrew the second hour of the program. I think Paige is with us now. Paige, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Paige.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you very much.
Great.
Well, this is a not ongoing story, isn't it? You could write about this every single day, which I guess you've had to do. What's going on with these moderate Democrats and some Republicans who are trying to make some changes to make the Affordable Care Act a little more workable?
Right. Well, there's this bipartisan group in the House. They call themselves the Problem Solvers Coalition. And then there's another group called the New Democrats. And they sort of term themselves as kind of the moderate Democrats. And some of the members from these two groups came together to propose a series of things that lawmakers could potentially move ahead on. And in this package, they recommend funding for these extra Obamacare subsidies, which, of course, would significantly help the marketplaces. And they also suggest repealing just one of the ACA's taxes, its medical device tax, a provision giving states greater flexibility to manage their marketplaces, and then also creating this new federal fund to help states cover the cost of more expensive patients. This package of ideas are all things that these moderates have identified as something that, you know, Congress might be able to come together on now that there's been this massive collapse of just this, you know, partisan Republican approach of repeal and replace. And so you saw them trying to kind of advance these ideas late last week and then early this week as it became apparent that the GOP-only approach just isn't working. So far, the ideas don't seem to have really caught on with leadership. You saw Nancy Pelosi give a nod to the ideas. She mentioned them earlier this week and said she's really pleased to see some bipartisan solutions, but she hasn't necessarily endorsed those ideas. And we've seen no response really from Speaker Paul Ryan or Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And so I think over recess, it'll become more clear whether or not there's really going to be momentum for Congress to move together on some of these potentially bipartisan fixes.
Mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell has said that we're going to move on. We've had our vote. We're moving on to tax reform. What does he intend to do then? Would it be his desire that the marketplaces not be fixed, that Obamacare still run into some problem areas, or is it something else?
You know, McConnell seems very conscious of the fact that Republicans can will probably own the problems going forward with the marketplaces. Publicly, he has said that Congress would be unwilling to fund these extra cost-sharing subsidies without some cooperation from Democrats on maybe some changes to the ACA. But I've heard that he's had sort of offline conversations with the White House and has really urged President Trump in particular that these subsidy payments really do need to be made to insurers so that the marketplaces aren't looking even worse, you know, next year. Now, whether or not the White House is going to heed that call from McConnell is still unclear. You know, Trump has been taking to Twitter over the last week or so, threatening to hold these subsidies hostage unless Republicans try again on repeal replace. But I think behind the scenes, McConnell and other Republicans are pretty dismayed that Trump is trying to use these subsidies as a bargaining chip.
So Republicans are starting to not listen to the president on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, they're not really going to come out publicly and criticize Trump for his approach. But I think behind the scenes, they realize that if they withheld these subsidies and then insurers go ahead with some of these massive double-digit rate hikes in the marketplaces, right, which they've said this would be a possibility if they don't get the subsidies, I think they realize that regular Americans that are buying insurance on the exchanges are going to blame Congress and the White House because they don't have anyone else to blame at this point besides the Republicans that hold the reins.
You've written that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said that he's received responses from 10 of his Republican colleagues. He said that he's all for the concepts laid out in the problem solver's proposal. Is that a significant number? And do you think over the next month or so he'll get more than 10?
He could. I mean, I think a lot of it's going to be driven by Senator Lamar Alexander, who, of course, is chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee, one of the big two big health care committees in the Senate. And Alexander has really been the senator on the forefront of wanting to move forward on bipartisan work. He came out with his Democratic counterpart, Patty Murray, earlier this week and said that they're going to hold a series of hearings on the marketplaces in September. Once Congress returns from recess. I wouldn't be surprised if some of these proposals showed up in those help hearings. And then I think that McConnell would be open to moving forward on some of these initiatives if he saw, you know, enough support from Democrats. And, you know, certainly there are enough moderate Republicans who don't want to bear the blame for imploding marketplaces, and enough moderate Democrats as well who have already been proposing fixes and acknowledging problems with the ACA over the past few months. I think if you took those two groups and put them together, you could potentially have enough votes to move forward on legislation.
Mm-hmm. I would think, Paige, that there are still a whole lot of Americans who are really concerned about this, worried about premiums going up, worried about insurance, worried about what's going to happen with the ACA. Nothing is very settled.
Well, right. I mean, there's been the first thing is there's been a lot of confusion. I mean, if you recall when Trump took office in January, his administration pretty quickly pulled back on advertising at the end of the last open enrollment season. And there was so much rhetoric about repeal replace that I think a lot of people were just confused about whether they could even still buy marketplace plans. And that's a really big consideration now going into the 2018 enrollment season. You know, I've been talking to HHS and CMS about their approach. And so far, it sounds like, and we haven't confirmed this yet, but it sounds like they're not really planning on advertising around enrollment. They're not they're planning on, you know, discontinuing a lot of these strategies that the Obama administration had undergone to try to, you know, convince people to sign up. And that could further undermine, you know, the marketplaces if people don't know where to sign up, and also maybe don't realize that the enrollment season is actually only going to be half the time as in past years. Normally the enrollment season runs November through January. This year it's only going to be 6 weeks from November 1st to December 15th.
Oh, I didn't know that. So this idea to let the whole thing implode is still a strategy that could be used.
Well, yeah, I mean, if Trump decides not to make these payments, insurers pretty much across the board have said, we're already going to have to hike rates no matter what. If we don't get these subsidies, we're going to hike them even more. You know, California yesterday came out and said that its plans on the marketplace are going to go up an average of 12% next year, but it would be double if they don't get the subsidies. And so Trump very much holds that power right now. Although I should mention that there is an ongoing court case over these subsidies, and if the Trump administration drops an appeal in this case, basically what that means is that Congress would have to appropriate the money in order for these payments to be made. And so while Trump kind of holds the reins right now, you could see that power shifting from the administration over to Congress in the next month or so, depending on the actions the administration takes on this separate court case.
And who's filing the court case?
Well, so this is a court case that was filed a couple of years ago by the House and by House Republicans. And at the time, they really wanted to ping the Obama administration for making these payments. They said basically because these subsidies have not been appropriated by Congress, it's illegal for the administration to make these payments. And so they filed this lawsuit. And actually last year, a federal court sided with the House and said, actually, you're right. The administration has been making these payments illegally, and so Congress has to appropriate the funding. Well, then things got super weird because Republicans didn't realize that then they were going to have their own party controlling the White House. And so now it's up to the Trump administration to decide whether or not to appeal that ruling. If the administration does appeal the ruling, this case would, you know, continue for quite some time. If it doesn't, that decision would stand that Congress would have to appropriate the money.
So things are still super weird.
Yeah, exactly. But we should get a little bit more clarity further along in August. There's actually a deadline around August 20th or so for the administration to indicate to the court where its approach on that court case.
You've also done some interesting writing this week about what states are doing. We've heard like states like Ohio are going to lose all their insurers, but there have been insurance companies that are stepping up, right? So that some of the states where there were going to be no insurers, there are more insurers.
Right. There's actually been a wave of good news for the marketplaces over the last couple of weeks. Ohio, you're right, was one of the biggest problem areas. There were more than a dozen, might have been several dozen. I'm forgetting the exact number, but there were a lot of counties that potentially were going to be bare counties. Ohio said the state had been working really hard to convince some insurers to come into the marketplace. And the state was happy to announce this week that only one of its counties at this moment lack an insurer for next year. Now, that being said, it's still not a great situation to have, you know, only one plan option on the marketplaces, and certainly not what advocates of the Affordable Care Act and Democrats had envisioned when they were originally passing the law. But, you know, some of the states, Ohio and then also Missouri and Washington, those state insurance commissioners have been very active in trying to kind of woo and wine and dine these insurers to convince them to sell plans next year. So the outlook is looking better than it was, you know, say in the springtime.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Senate? Is there a chance they're going to vote again? And if so, when may they do this on another repeal bill?
You know, at this point, it's almost impossible to imagine a scenario in which the Senate could do repeal. I mean, they basically went through this whole exercise last week and proved that they just don't have the votes for virtually any kind of repeal bill. I mean, they tried their replace plan and that failed. And then they tried a fuller repeal bill and that failed. And then they tried their skinny repeal bill, which only cut back pretty small parts of the ACA. That failed, too, with that infamous vote from Senator John McCain. And so, you know, you'll hear optimism from Republicans, especially conservatives in the House and Senate, that are feeling, you know, pressure from their base and really want a repeal vote. But I think practically speaking, it's very hard to see how leadership could be persuaded to kind of return to this messy business of health care. All McConnell wants to do at this point is kind of put the whole thing behind him and move on.
Imagine. Were you surprised by the vote last Friday?
You know, I was. It had been so back and forth all week long, and as they came out with each new iteration, you know, it at first it seemed like things wouldn't fly, and then they would, and you were hearing all sorts of different things. It was a little bit surprising that it was McCain, you know, because he was not really one of the moderates that everyone had talked about all along as being a defector. I mean, everybody knew that Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska probably were going to, at the end of the day, vote against a repeal bill. But then everybody was watching, like, Dean Heller of Nevada, who's up for re-election next year, Shelley Moore Cabot of West Virginia, who had expressed a lot of hesitancies about most iterations of the legislation. But then it was, I guess, Thursday, when they were talking about doing the skinny repeal, that McCain started pushing back a lot. And, of course, McCain is a great example of a Republican who has nothing to lose, in a sense. I mean, most likely he's not going to be running for a Senate seat, you know, ever again. He won his seat last year. He can do what he wants at this point. And, you know, he prides himself on being a maverick and being an independent thinker. And so and also he'd been getting pressure from, you know, the governor of Arizona, who saw how the people of his state could be hurt by this repeal bill, because, of course, Arizona had expanded Medicaid. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I think McCain just thought to himself, you know, why would I vote for this legislation that my state doesn't like, my governor doesn't like, just to toe the Republican line? He just wasn't willing to do that.
Paige is with us this hour. Senator Tammy Baldwin will join us later in the hour to talk about bills that she has introduced and co-sponsored, dealing with prescription drug prices and also making the marketplaces more sustainable. Paige Winfield Cunningham is a healthcare reporter at the Washington Post, and she is the author of the Post Daily Health 202 newsletter. Welcoming your phone calls. What do you make of where everything is right now? Are you worried about the sustainability of the Affordable Care Act? Are you worried about your health care prices? Do you want the Senate to just not take further action? What about the president's request that the Senate vote again on this? It looks like that it doesn't stand a chance of passing. But do you have hopes that there will be more bipartisan working out of something that will fix the Affordable Care Act? Is that to your liking? Well, here's how you reach us with answers to those questions or whatever questions you have. 800-486-8655. We have some emails coming in, and we'll get to those in a moment. Our email is ideas@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network. Let's start with an email from Scott from Iron River, Page, who asks, what if all states had been pro-ACA initially? How would that have changed things?
Oh, it would have changed things pretty dramatically. You would see more people covered under Medicaid expansion, for one thing. You know, about, let's see, how many, 13, 14 states have chosen not to expand Medicaid because they are run by Republicans who are ideologically opposed to the ACA and also worried about, you know, state obligations for Medicaid spending. But if all of the states had embraced it, you know, you probably wouldn't have seen this lawsuit against the ACA. Remember the one back in 2012 when the individual mandate was challenged and other elements of the law. And ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled that states could actually opt out of Medicaid expansion if they chose to. That was not originally envisioned when the ACA was written back in 2012. At the time, everyone thought that the states would go ahead and naturally want to accept Medicaid expansion because the federal government was actually paying for most of the costs of these new enrollees. But that didn't turn out to be the case. And so that's actually one of the reasons that enrollment has been less under the ACA than originally projected, because there are fewer people enrolled in Medicaid.
Let's go to Jean in Appleton. Hi, Jean.
Yeah, hi. I want to say something rather controversial. I think it's easy to understand how precarious the ACA has become because all of those providing coverage are in it for profit. They're, all of the insurance companies are for profit. And I admit that the ACA probably wouldn't have become law if employer-provided coverage had been part of it. But because employer coverage is outside of the ACA, it prevents us from getting either single-payer or universal coverage. And if we could stop endlessly trying to reinvent the wheel and have single-payer, not-for-profit health care, I think it would be very good. I don't know how you can do it with the insurance company's power over what we currently have. And I think if there hadn't been so much of this talk for the last 7 years about repeal and replace, we wouldn't be in the precarious situation that we are now, where they talk about it maybe imploding.
Interesting call, Jean.
Well,
thanks.
Yeah, I just to respond to that a little bit, you know, it is, some people have argued that it's inefficient and expensive for the federal government to subsidize these private plans, and that in a way it's kind of the worst of both worlds, because you have the government regulating insurers, but the insurers still basically have the power to hike rates if they want to. But the caller's right that we have this long-established employer-sponsored coverage system, you know, that emerged after World War II, which is where a majority of Americans get their coverage. And so when we talk about the Affordable Care Act, we're just talking about, you know, the 40 million or so Americans who aren't on Medicare or Medicaid or employer-sponsored, who get their coverage through the individual market. And then the challenges of how to provide those people with coverage. And what we found under the ACA is, even with all of its tools to try to get coverage to these people, you know, the individual mandate requiring them to buy coverage or face a penalty, and all of the subsidies available to help make their coverage more affordable, you still have the ACA really only reduced the uninsured rate among these people by half. And so you still have about 20 million Americans who lack coverage. And so it's really hard under this system that the ACA sets out to get to that, you know, universal coverage point that you see in a lot of other developed countries.
Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we're talking about health care after the vote down for the skinny repeal bill last Friday. What's happening now? Is there a bipartisan discussion going on? Will that happen? Will Obamacare be just sort of left out and fail and not be fixed? We welcome your phone calls. And we are going to be joined by Senator Tammy Baldwin. I'm just trying to figure out. We have two guests with us. Paige Winfield Cunningham is a healthcare reporter at the Washington Post, and she's been covering all of this a lot for quite a long time now. And Senator Tammy Baldwin, I'm just trying to figure out where she is. And Senator Baldwin, are you here?
I am.
Oh, you are. I don't know. Oh, okay. I didn't know where to find you, but now I know where to find you. Senator Baldwin is with us, and she, of course, Senator Tammy Baldwin, she's been a U.S. senator from our fair state since 2013, served as the member of the Wisconsin House of Representatives from 1999 to 2013. Let's talk about what you've been up to, Senator Baldwin, this week. You have introduced legislation to allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices to lower costs for seniors. Any chance of that getting passed, and why are you doing it?
Well, certainly when we pivoted from that very dramatic vote last week, where the repeal efforts finally came to an end, we're now resolved to work together to stabilize the insurance markets, to bring costs down generally, but certainly to go after the high cost of prescription drugs, something that I am hearing a lot about from constituents. And so I think there is common ground to be found on that issue. And I've actually been involved in a number of efforts. The one you name, Kathleen, the use of the negotiating power and leverage of Medicare with its 41 million beneficiaries and participants to negotiate with pharmaceutical corporations to bring prices down would make an enormous difference. And sadly, in current law, the federal government, through the Medicare program, is prohibited from doing so, and we'd like to change that. But I'm also involved in some efforts that have received greater and broader bipartisan support. Sadly, too often this Medicare negotiation issue has not been bipartisan. We hope that changes. But I would also raise the Fair Drug Pricing Act that I authored along with John McCain, which holds drug corporations to account in a very different way, and that is through transparency and accountability, requiring any drug corporation that wants to raise their prices more than 10% to have to do a pretty thorough disclosure of what justifies that price increase. Is it stock buybacks? Is it CEO pay? Or is it R&D? Or the cost of manufacturing right. that product has changed? And so that is one that I'm also going to be pushing when we return in September and hopefully can achieve some bipartisan progress on mm-hmm. this really critical issue.
Senator Baldwin, why is it that Congress can't take up the issue? I don't know if they ever have, really, of looking at not only the cost of prescription drugs, but also the high cost of health care. We're talking about all of these bills, but nobody's taken on, really, a deep analysis of why it is that health care in this country is more expensive than anywhere else. Will Congress do that? Should they?
I think it's necessary. I think that we know that the increase in cost of health care year to year outpaces inflation in other types of commerce, and they're really not directly comparable in some ways. But unless we start getting transparency in all aspects of health care, those are thorny issues to tackle. And, there's been some studies that have gotten a lot of discussion in Congress but have not pivoted into action. And I think about, the comparison of what hospitalization might cost, what sort of bills a patient would get if that patient is covered by private insurance, by Medicare, or is uninsured. And we know that it's not the same for those three classes of patients. That's absurd. And so those are some of the things we absolutely ought to do. And I think there'd be bipartisan support for that. Regrettably, these past many months, we have been, the ability to work across the aisle has been sort of hijacked by this this long effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act and take health care away from far too many Wisconsinites and Americans.
So after Friday's vote, when the skinny repeal went down, is it a belief that bipartisan deliberation and refashioning of the Affordable Care Act so that the problems in that bill are fixed is a possibility, Senator Baldwin, or not?
I'm feeling very encouraged by what I have heard from colleagues on both sides of the aisle in the Senate, as well as my own commitment to my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to work on this. This is what this is the moment we've been waiting for. And I sit on the Senate Health Panel. The Chairman Lamar Alexander and the ranking Democrat Patty Murray both pledged to work together through the August recess and with hearings right when we come back in the beginning of September. I joined that call for bipartisanship. This would focus initially on stabilizing the insurance market. And not only that, but just, you know, an hour or so ago, I had a chance to talk in further depth with Senator Alexander about those efforts. I will say, though, as again, a caveat, that as the Senate has turned its attention to how we can work together to address these problems, the president has continued to tweet over the weekend that maybe he'll withhold a critical payment called the cost-sharing reduction payment that allows health plans to be available with lower deductibles and lower out-of-pocket costs. And if that payment isn't made by President Trump and his administration, people will be harmed. And so not everybody is right yet on the tune of bipartisanship and working together. The White House in recent days has continued to say, nothing else until you do the repeal, and we'll do things to sabotage or destroy the underlying health law.
Does he have the authority to do that by himself?
Sadly, yes. The cost-sharing reduction payments have been paid by the Secretary of Health and Human Services at the direction of the president for a number of years. So far, the Trump administration has been making those payments. But every month, it seems the president threatens not to. And if you look closely at some of the statements from insurance companies that have pulled out of the marketplaces, it is uncertainty over whether that payment will be made that has either led them to withdraw. It's part of their thinking in withdrawing from the marketplaces, or they've sort of hedged by saying, we're going to increase our premiums significantly next year based on uncertainty over whether the president is going to continue to authorize these payments.
And how is uncertainty right now? How are people in America dealing with the uncertainty of the Affordable Care Act? We were talking with Paige about how the period where you sign up is much, much shorter. There's no advertising, so people know that they can sign up for this. And everything is it secretive or it's uncertain, which must make a lot of people nervous.
Absolutely. Well, on that latter point about the changes the Trump administration made shortly after the president took office relating to shortening the enrollment period, cutting the advertising budget so that we aren't able to do a good as job as a government to say, the insurance exchanges, the marketplaces are out there, and especially reaching target audiences like young people who might be going off their parents' health insurance and needing to get coverage, but their first job may be a job that doesn't offer health care coverage. So I hope that as we work across the party aisle to stabilize the market, that reversing some of these Trump administration decisions relating to marketing of the marketplace will be a part of that discussion. But it is deeply disturbing to me to have a president that is, while trying to score the political point of following through on a campaign promise, is actually harming Americans. And the last thing I want to say about your question, Kathleen, is I think the ability last week to get a majority of the Senate to vote basically to keep the Affordable Care Act in place and reject this repeal and skinny replacement, I think that's a victory for the American people who called, wrote, attended town hall meetings, told their healthcare stories. When you say, how is this impacting people? It's impacting them in the pocketbook because of the uncertainty. But I think it took an emotional toll, too. I can't tell you how many parents with sick children or children with pre-existing conditions I spoke with tears in their eyes, saying, I can't believe, you know, I live in a country where they would subject us to so much risk, and, you know, they want their loved ones to be healthy and get the best care possible if they're not healthy.
Let's take a couple phone calls for you. Senator Tammy Baldwin is with us for a few more minutes. Paige remains with us. Healthcare is with us for the whole hour. And where we go from last week's vote, our number is 800-486-8655. Nancy in Madison, hi.
Hi. A couple of things. One, I just signed up our 26-year-old son for the Affordable Health Care Act, and I'm so grateful that it was there to do exactly what Senator Baldwin just mentioned about 26-year-olds. And secondly, the bipartisanship role is just thrilling. I'm so excited, and I want to thank Senator Baldwin and the other Democrats, but I'd really also like to just thank the Republicans. McCain, John Strauss, who's actually been called a, quote, traitor by the Republican Party, for people just remembering that civil servants serve all people regardless of their political affiliation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Senator Baldwin.
What a lovely reminder to all of us. It is about serving. And, you know, I share Nancy's encouragement about the bipartisanship. It has yet to show results. There's been a commitment. It's been verbal. It happened in our Senate Health Committee meeting this week. But now we got to see it through. I do believe that when you're talking about policy that affects every American and one-sixth of our economy, we've got to work together and do it right. And the last thing I want to say about Nancy's call is just a non-humble moment for a second, but I was the House author of the amendment that allows 26 young people to stay on the on their parents' health insurance until they're 26. And I was so proud to be a champion for that issue. It's made such a difference for so many young people whose first jobs don't necessarily have insurance, or who might be going through college without easy access to health insurance. And I'm glad it made a big difference for Nancy's son.
Well, it was wildly popular, and nobody wants to let that one go, right?
That's right.
I don't. Senator Baldwin, thank you so much.
Kathleen, can I also say I am going to so miss you on the air, but thank you for your many, many years of service also.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor and a pleasure, a whole lot of fun, too.
Excellent.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks, Senator Baldwin.
All right.
Senator Tammy Baldwin talking about health care as well. We go back to phone calls. Paige is still with us. We're talking about what road after yesterday was last week's vote in the Senate. And Paige is still with us. Paige Cunningham is a health care reporter at The Washington Post and writing extensively about this issue. And as you can tell, she knows it. Let's go to Terry in Colfax. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi.
One of my questions was, as I'm really astounded after all these years through some presidents that this health care wasn't looked at as far as the details. And the comment by President Trump, he didn't know health care was so complicated, yet he was going to drop Obamacare when he became president. I can understand why citizens across the United States are not only upset, but they can't understand how you can have a leader of a country that acts like a spoiled child, especially when it comes to human lives.
Thanks for your call, Terry. Paige.
Well, that quote you referenced has been repeated many times by Democrats and people who have been very dismayed at how Trump has kind of handled all of this. You know, I actually wouldn't put the blame, though, on Trump for this whole Obamacare repeal replace messaging, because it really started a long time before Trump was even a player in American politics. I mean, Republicans saw it as a really effective political tool way back in 2010, and they used it to win back the House that year. And then they saw that it helped them win elections, and so they kept going with it. And, you know, up until Trump became the nominee, he had been a longtime backer of a single-payer system. He was much more aligned with where Democrats would be on health care. And then when he became the Republican nominee, he kind of globbed on to that repeal, replace, Obamacare is horrible message I think it's safe to say, without fully understanding perhaps the policy and sort of the nuances of how the Affordable Care Act works and how it extends coverage to people. And so I think that lack of knowledge was kind of apparent when he made the comment earlier this year. And then even this spring, you know, he, I think, was dismayed when he saw the Republican plans that the House and Senate came out with and the projections that they would cost, 22 million or so Americans their coverage. And, I think Trump really thought that there was a way to pass a plan that would be better than Obamacare and that it would extend coverage to people. But that's because he didn't really understand the difficulty of the situation and the ideological standpoint where his party's coming from, which is that they're just unwilling to spend as much money as Democrats to get coverage to people. And as a result, they found themselves in this bind of legislation, which would have freed up insurers from, some of these mandates and individual Americans from some of these mandates, and yet would have also rolled back coverage. Mm-hmm. And so he was dismayed when he saw those plans come out, and even chastised Senate Republicans occasionally at the White House, where he said their plan lacked heart and told them that they needed to be nicer with their health care policy.
From what I've read, Paige, and you'll know the answer to this, the president kind of gave the whole responsibility to Congress, that you would imagine most presidents would be very involved with the intricacies of healthcare legislation because it is something that's so important to people, and people vote on this issue and it affects people's lives. Was the president not involved? Did he help craft legislation? Did he offer input?
I would say as he was involved insofar as Congress felt heavy pressure from the White House over the winter and spring and then into the summer. A few times when the effort in the House seemed to stall, Trump dispatched Vice President Pence to Capitol Hill. He sent HHS Secretary Tom Price over to the Hill to try to convince members. Trump would even call in individual Republicans or groups of Republicans sometimes to the White House to castigate them. There was sort of that infamous moment where Trump called House Speaker Paul Ryan in, I think it was in March or so, and it was right before the House was supposed to go on recess, and Trump said, "You have got to find a way to advance this health care bill. You cannot sort of leave me high and dry on my promise to repeal Obamacare." And that actually did seem to kind of light a fire, if you will, under Ryan. And then you saw some amendments added to the bill, and ultimately the House was able to pass it. So I think that Republicans have been cognizant of this pressure from Trump. At the same time, Trump himself doesn't understand the policy. And so you could argue that he, in a sense, has kind of undermined their efforts at the same time by framing the issue sometimes as or framing their legislation as being, you know, lacking generosity or being unkind, which sort of goes against the image or the talking points that Republicans were supposed to spread. Were trying to spread about their plan. They were trying to frame it as, enabling freedom for people and lifting regulations from insurers and individuals. And that, Trump undermined that messaging at certain points.
More phone calls in a moment. Healthcare is our subject this hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. Let's go to Ron in Madison. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a Republican who's been thinking about healthcare for, at least 35 years. I even proposed a plan to former Senator Larry Craig of Idaho, which I passed on recently to Senator Johnson. I doubt he'd do anything about that. I really appreciate what Senator Baldwin has said, particularly about the pharmaceutical issue and negotiating prices. I'm a senior now, so I am on Medicare myself. Mm-hmm. Those are good issues for me. I don't agree with her on single payer, because although I don't have a lot of love for insurance companies, they take in a lot of money that they invest in the economic structure. And as an economic major, I appreciate that. So my plan had been somewhat similar to Obamacare, but much, much more comprehensive. Not sure it would work either, but it might put something into the mix.
Send it off to Senator Baldwin, Ron.
Beg your pardon?
If we're trying to get bipartisan discussion of the issue, send it off to
yes.
Senator Baldwin as well.
Yes, I really appreciate that. That's one thing I gather from what she was saying, is that they're trying to do a bipartisan thing, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think people would appreciate a bipartisan effort, so why the heck don't people just sit down and get this thing hashed out, Paige?
Well, I think that healthcare, you have seen bipartisan efforts certainly on healthcare before, in the years before the ACA. So, you know, Medicare and Medicaid were a bipartisan effort. There were a number of changes to Medicare since then. You had Medicare Advantage passed on a bipartisan basis. You saw the prescription D benefit passed in the early 2000s, passed on a bipartisan basis. And then even since the ACA, there's been work on this, they fixed this Medicare doctor's payment formula called the Sustainable Growth Rate Formula. That happened 2 years ago. But I think the discussion around Obamacare has just caused healthcare in general to become so toxic because it's just been so politicized. And your average American, and even I would say your average lawmaker in Congress right now, couldn't even tell you what's in the Affordable Care Act. Remember, a lot of these Republicans who are in the House now won their seats simply by railing against the ACA without having a depth of knowledge about what's in it because they weren't around when it was passed in 2010. And so if you've won your seat on this promise, it's going to be very hard, I think, for you to turn around and be willing to work with Democrats to fix it if all along your message has been, you know, trash the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare is the worst, et cetera. And so I think those bad vibes are just there in Congress, and that's why it's going to be really hard for Democrats and Republicans to move forward in a bipartisan way on
mm-hmm.
this.
Thanks, Ron. Jerry and Spooner, hi.
Do we know what the, well, of course you know, but the monthly payments for the subsidies, just for the Affordable Health Care Act, is it $4 to $6 billion? Am I close with that number?
So the CBO has estimated that the annual payments are around $7 billion. And to put that in perspective, if you look at all of the subsidies the federal government is paying into the marketplace, so this includes also the premium subsidies, the cost-sharing subsidies are about 15% of the total subsidies. And so that's a pretty significant portion. You know, it probably wouldn't entirely sink the marketplaces if they don't get these payments, but it would certainly have a big effect on the rates for next year.
And Mac from Dunn County emails, the Trump Republican plan is not to let the ACA implode. It is to make the ACA implode. Clearly, their efforts are focused on actively undermining and or blocking easily implemented minor fixes. Do you have a point?
You know, there one thing we haven't talked about is the time frame of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think because the time frame is really closing for insurers to finalize their plans for next year. You know, they're supposed to, I believe, next week submit final rates, and then there's kind of this drop-dead time in September. Right, it's around September 20th or so that they have to submit their final plan. Things can't be changed after that point. And so, you know, the time frame is so tight here, and insurers really, really need the certainty. And so I think that the Trump administration does really, they have the power to either give insurers that certainty they need for next year, or they have the power to withhold that certainty.
Mm. So it'll be an anxious month for people. Paige, thank you very much for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Paige Winfield Cunningham, she's a healthcare reporter at the Washington Post and covers these healthcare issues, knows all the bills, knows the politics of this. She also has reported at the Washington Examiner and at Politico. We also thank Senator Tammy Baldwin for being with us. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing the show, to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Please stay with us. You don't want to miss Andrew Solomon. He has had a fascinating life. He's a very deep thinker, and he's done a remarkable work here, Far From the Tree, now out with a young adult edition. And we will talk about that with him and with you right after the news.